Welcome to Sounding Off with Kim Munson, our podcast. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You'll get first look at all of the upcoming guests, where these podcasts are first rolled out, as well as our op-eds. And then go over to Facebook and give us a like as well. We would really appreciate that. On the line with me is my friend, Dr. Jill Vecchio. She is one of the few people that actually read the PPACA Act, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And so she knows what's in it. And we've been talking about healthcare, and we need to fix healthcare in America. But Dr. Jill, in this particular podcast, let's talk about where we are and then your 10-point solutions to fix healthcare. So Dr. Jill Vecchio, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Kim.
So how did we get here, Dr. Jill?
Well, you know, and I've spoken about this many times for many years, and it's surprising how many people don't understand kind of the history of what healthcare used to be in our country and the steps that it took bit by bit to turn into the mess that it is now. And then Obamacare made it more of a mess, and then people talking about Medicare for all. So I would kind of like to go through basically kind of our history in healthcare so that people really have a grasp of how things came about and how the healthcare system works, what is good about it, what's not good about it, and then how we can change as much as possible. We as consumers can change it, and then what some of the things that government needs to do for it.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Okay. Once upon a time, this was when I was a kid, and even before that, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, families had what they would call like a major medical insurance policy, kind of what we would call today a catastrophic policy for big ticket items like cancers, long hospitalizations, big illnesses, that sort of thing. The doctor and patient had an intimate relationship. Your family doctor took care of you. You paid them directly unless it was some major medical issue. And healthcare, I mean, it could be very expensive for people who didn't have the major medical, but for the most part, it worked for the vast majority of people. Hospitals and providers could decide among themselves to give pro bono care and not be paid for care. They didn't have to deal with the insurance companies all that much. It was a transaction between people and between providers and their patients.
Okay.
Once World War II, at the end of World War II, there were a lot of businesses that were competing for employees. In order to, and the government, after World War II, put a post-war salary freeze on companies so they couldn't compete for employees by raising
by paying
salaries.
Them more.
And,
the government,
by salary bidding.
Yeah, the government said you can't pay people more. Can you believe that?
Right, right. And you'll see throughout this talk that it's government interference that has created the problems we have in healthcare. So we shouldn't be looking to them to fix it. So this is one instance. So the government puts a salary freeze on. Employers have to figure out how to compete for this limited resource of workers. So they start offering benefits, health insurance benefits, life insurance benefits, that sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Country club memberships, whatever. So that's where health insurance got tied to the workplace, right? That's going to come up later. So thanks to the government, health insurance got tied to your job. When you left your job, you lost that insurance policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Either had to go on your own and have to deal with pre-existing conditions, or you took on a new insurance policy and maybe had to change your doctor or whatever when you started your new job.
Okay.
Okay, next comes Medicare and Medicaid in the 60s. Now we have government administering healthcare. They work usually Medicaid is through state and federal government. And just for people, Medicaid is people under 65, indigent and so forth. And we had a Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. Medicare is primarily people over 65. Some people can get a combination of Medicare and Medicaid and, you know, disability through Social Security, that sort of thing. But government has gotten, it's now in the 60s, government started getting its fingers into administering health care for people by paying for their health care. When that happened, it turned health care into a limited resource. We've talked about this many times on your show, what a limited resource means, and I'll go into that a little bit more. So now we have another case of government stepping in and creating more problems in health care and solving, not solving problems, creating more.
Them, okay.
Right.
Okay.
And now, also because government got involved, now we have government officials, congressmen, and government bureaucrats making decisions about our lives, and they are influenced by what? Lobbyists.
Aha.
Right?
Okay.
So if government had not gotten involved, we would not have Big Pharma being the largest lobbying organization, that and oil and gas, right? The pharmaceutical companies are the biggest lobbying organizations, insurance companies, health insurance companies. We've got tort lawyers that won't allow tort reform. You like the Trial Lawyers Association is another huge lobbying group. AARP, all the doctors groups, AMA, and all that. So now because government has gotten involved, now we have corruption in the system. Okay?
Okay.
So at this point, and this is a key concept for people to understand and have in the back of their mind, the problem with our healthcare system is that we have now created a system as of the 60s where the person giving the care, i.e. the healthcare provider, and the person getting the care, the patient, are bureaucratically, in other words, inefficiently, separated by the person paying for the care, whether that be the insurance company, the private insurance company, or the government insurance company. That's the key problem. Now, because you've got somebody else paying for the care, I'll tell you what, whoever pays makes the rules. So the insurance company is making the rules, the government is making the rules. When the government is making the rules, they are now subject to corruption through lobbying efforts and lobbying entities. Now we can talk about the right to health care, because a lot of people are saying, well, the government should be in charge of health care because health care is a right and they have to administer this right to health care. What we need to understand from these people who say there's a right to health care, the first thing you ask them is, what do you mean by a right to health care? Do you mean equality in health care, like all the socialized universal health care systems that every other developed wealthy country has in the world? Lots of variations of those. None of them are working. I'll talk about that in a minute. Are you talking about equality in health care? Because if you want everybody to have equal health care, by definition, it has to go to the lowest common denominator. The quality has to go to the lowest common denominator in order for it to be equal across the population, right? That's why America supposedly scored 37th in the world in health care. It wasn't because we have bad health care. It's because we have really great health care that therefore costs a lot. And there's a wide range of health care levels that people can have, from Medicaid and health clinics, free health clinics, up to Mayo and, you know, all of these high-end MD Anderson and all these cancer centers, Cleveland Clinic, right? That's equality in health care. So you don't want really equality in health care because you can never achieve equal health care at the highest level. You can't. Nobody has. Are you talking about the right to free health care? Because if you're talking about the right to free health care, then you're telling me that you have the right to reach into my pocket and take money from me for something that you need or think you need. Is that right? Most people will not admit. There are a lot of them that will. But most people don't want to admit that that's what they think they can do. It's also saying to every healthcare provider that they have a right. You think you have a right to my skills and knowledge as a physician. You think you have a right to my skills and knowledge. You don't. So that's where we need to attack the right to health care. There is no right to health care. Now, you have a right to access, you know, to pursue health care, but you don't have a right to health, to free health care, and we don't want equality in health care. So the health insurance industry, at this point, we are prepaid health insurance, prepaid health care. So you pay a premium to an insurance company, they have all these coverages, and just since Obamacare now, so many policies now have a huge deductible. Before Obamacare, there were a few thousand of these high deductible policies, but they had lower premiums as a result because then it was offset. If you said, I'm going to agree to have a higher deductible, then I don't need as many coverages. I just want something for big ticket items.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Obamacare, every policy sold had to have this whole list of coverages, including mammography and preventive care and pregnancy care and all that, maternity care, baby car seats, and everything. So the premiums for Obamacare compliant policies had to be, became so high that it was like $25,000 a year, we'll say $20,000 a year for those premiums. And in order to keep the premiums even that low under Obamacare, the insurance companies had to have these huge high deductibles of $6,000 or $8,000 a year. So let's look at, so $20,000 a year for a premium with a $6,000 deductible, $26,000 you're shelling out, and most people are hardly using any of it. Even they're still paying $20,000 for healthcare they're not even using because they never meet the deductible, right?
This is so difficult for like young families, young people.
They're not getting insured. They're bypassing insurance. How many young families do you know that don't even have insurance because of this?
Wow.
Right. So now we've had prepaid health care, not insurance. When you had just the catastrophic or the major medical policy, that's true insurance. You think about your car insurance, it doesn't pay for, and we've said this many times, but it doesn't pay for oil changes or new tires. You pay for that, mm-hmm. and then you pay a pretty small amount for your car insurance for big ticket items, you know, car accidents, injuries, that sort of thing. Now, so with healthcare, we're spending $26,000, or we'll say a lot of people are spending maybe $26,000 with deductible and premiums for healthcare that they're not using. That's ridiculous. So you think what you could do with that $26,000?
Oh my gosh,
that's a lot. Now,
just a quick comment. You know, so we have PBIs, politicians, bureaucrats, interested parties, lawyers, that they wring their hands about affordable housing for young people. My gosh, if a young family had, you know, let's say that they had a $6,000 deductible in the numbers you just gave, they'd have $20,000 a couple of years. They're starting to have a nest egg that they could buy a house.
Right. Or pay cash for health care.
Right.
And we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later. You could actually pay cash for health care and put a down payment on a house.
Well, that sounds like a good plan.
Yes. So then with health insurance, we had the issue of pre-existing conditions because now it's tied to the workplace. You lose your job, now you have to try and get an individual policy, and you have pre-existing conditions, so you can't be insured. At one point, before I even had any cancers, I was uninsurable because I'd had breast biopsies that were benign, but it was like, oh, now I'm uninsured. You can't even give me a policy? You can't even offer me a policy? Are you kidding? So that became a problem. Then we have state and federal insurance mandates where every policy that's sold in a state had to have certain coverages. Well, Obamacare increased that level of coverages for every insurance policy in the country, and that's what created the huge – that now it wasn't a crisis before Obamacare, I don't think. Now it really is a crisis because so many people who had insurance couldn't afford the premiums anymore, and they had to drop the insurance entirely because they couldn't even get a policy – because they'd have to pay these premiums in order to comply with Obamacare, right?
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, and now with the insurance companies, they have all these requirements before they'll pay you. You have to go through all this paperwork. You may have to submit paperwork, you know, three or four times. You have to hire people just to fill out the forms for these little coding numbers for a code for the disease and then a code for the treatment, and all those codes have to match up, and I mean, it's such a bureaucratic and paperwork nightmare that provider overhead has increased so much that now 70% of doctors no longer own their own business, their own practice. They are now employees of huge groups or hospital corporations or medical corporations, and that deteriorates the quality of care because you no longer control your own destiny. You no longer are able to hire the people that you think are best for the patient. It's all handled by a corporation, and we all know what happens with that.
Wow. Okay.
So you've had increased patient and provider frustration, interference in medical decision-making. Then you have the networks problem where people can't change insurance companies and keep their own position necessarily. I mean, it's ridiculous. You have defensive medicine, you know, the health records and all this just garbage that interferes with our ability to just take care of the patient. And needless to say, there's an increased complexity where patients are just overwhelmed. There's no way they could ever think that they could navigate the insurance system on their own or the medical system on their own, so that they think the only option they have is to have this insurance. Obamacare made this worse because, as I said, the mandated coverage, it flipped around. The number of uninsured stayed the same under Obamacare, and I think a lot of people don't know that. The reason they passed Obamacare, there are 25 million people uninsured. Well, at the end of Obamacare, after it was, you know, as fully implemented as we got, which was like up to 2016, the same number, 25 million people, were still uninsured. The problem is the original uninsured, when Obamacare passed, they went on to the Medicaid rolls. Now the 25 million uninsured are people who had insurance.
Wow.
And Obamacare, you know, increased the premium so much that they dropped insurance. So you had these people who are trying to be responsible citizens, and they had to drop their insurance because they couldn't afford to pay for it. Yet all of their taxes, they have taxes and stuff, they're paying for all the people who are now on Medicaid.
Oh my gosh.
You know, so
they're getting squeezed. They're getting squeezed, trying to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
They're getting squeezed. Yeah.
And the same number of people are uninsured under Obamacare. And there are more people that are underinsured. And even the Democrats said that, especially in Colorado, when they were trying to pass Amendment 69 for single-payer health care in Colorado in 2016. Was it 2018? Mm-hmm. Nope, it was 2016. They tried to pass that Amendment 69, and they even claimed, well, now we have more uninsured and underinsured people than under Obamacare. So they know it. They just, you know, they talk about it when it suits their purpose.
When it's convenient, yep.
Exactly. Now when we talk about Medicare for All, now we're talking about limited resource. So whenever you have single-payer health care or Medicare for All, which is really Medicaid for All, but Medicare for All, you're talking about the government taking a certain amount of money from each person, and usually they distribute this among increased income taxes, increased payroll taxes that you don't notice after a while, right? The idea of the payroll deduction is one of the worst things to happen to our country, because after a while, you don't even notice it. Or sometimes if it's just a couple of dollars, you don't notice it. So the payroll deduction is just an evil, but they'll use payroll deduction, income taxes, VAT taxes, increased sales taxes, to bring money into the government, and a lot of it you don't even notice is going there. And then you'll have the very small premium payment. And you go, oh, my health care is practically free. I only pay $30 a month for my health care, and isn't it great? I get everything I want. You know, in the first place, you have to go more on to believe that that's really the case, but plenty of kids do. And, you know, plenty of people do. I should say even adults do. They don't look at the whole picture. They don't understand what all is being taken from them for this pot of money. Now you have one pot of money. You have one pie. And now you've got doctors, hospitals, providers, patients all trying to get a little bite of that pie. And if they take a bite out of that pie, that means that somebody else cannot take a bite out of the pie because it's gone, right? That's a limited resource.
Okay.
So if you have a single pot of money taken from by the government or by any entity, even if they have private insurance companies administering the process, there's a single pot of money. And that's the same thing with kind of HMOs and those, I can't remember what they were called. It might come to me later. But there are kinds of Kaiser and some of these groups had the same idea of having a single pot of money, and those all those programs went bust years ago, after when Clintons were in office. But anyway, whenever you have that limited resource, it means that somebody has to be powerful enough to control how the pie, the pieces of the pie, get divvied out. Well, that right there tells you that who's going to be at the bottom of that pile, mm-hmm. the person with the smallest voice, mm-hmm. and that person is going to be the patient, right?
Wow.
So that's what's happened in these countries with universal health care, like Japan, France, Germany, Britain, Canada, Sweden, Taiwan. Patients pay all this money in, that a lot of which they don't even understand that they're paying in for this health care. Then the government makes control, or has control over the decisions that can be made by the providers, the hospitals, what equipment they can use, what medications they can prescribe. In Japan, primary health care providers, primary care providers, see 100 to 150 patients per day.
Oh, my gosh.
They have 2 to 5 minutes with each patient, and as a result, they write more prescriptions in Japan than in any country in the world. Well, yeah, 2 to 5 minutes. It hurts here. Here, take this. See you, bye. Next. You know?
Wow.
So they're not getting good care. The doctors are getting burnt out so quickly, they leave the government system and go out into private practice where it's cash pay only, and that works for them. Cash pay system works for them. All of these universal health care countries have a two-tiered system. It always starts out with a single tier. Ooh, isn't this great what the government is doing for you? And they find out really quickly that it's not going to work. So if you have enough money, just like socialism and everything else, if you have enough money, you get to get out of that national health care. You're still paying into it. But if you want health care, if you want quality health care, you want timely health care, then you have to pay cash outside of the system. So now you're paying double. And only the people that are wealthy enough can afford to pay double. So it's not good for the average person. It's not good. It's not making everything equal and fair. It's more unequal than what we have in America right now. The physicians are unhappy. How many Canadian physicians do we have working in the United States? I personally know 8 physicians that trained in Canada, came here for the residency and to work here in the States, and they've never gone back, and they would never go back.
Wow.
Let's see here. And also, let's face it, these other countries don't have malpractice problems the way they don't have as many lawyers. You know, the United States has more lawyers per capita than any country in the world. So, and that's part of that is the reason we have so much malpractice, because of the legal system
right.
in our country.
And as you mentioned earlier, the trial attorneys has a big lobbying group. We need tort reform on this, because you can sue anybody for anything in America, and people have to lawyer up when that happens.
Right.
And, of course, the trial attorneys like that.
Right. And doctors know that it's so disruptive to their practice to have to deal with a malpractice case. And granted, there is plenty of stuff that goes wrong, plenty that goes wrong. We're human beings. People make mistakes. Fine, you should have to pay for those mistakes. Absolutely, 100%, you should have to pay for those mistakes. The problem is you get lawyers who are and patients who are just filing a lawsuit because they're angry. And it's much more efficient for doctors and their malpractice insurance providers to settle the case and get rid of it and just, you know, get it off the books, even if it's a frivolous case. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean that somebody did anything wrong, but they're just like, just get it out of here so I can get back to my practice.
Right.
And that's and they know that, and the lawyers know that. So this is how. So when you have a single, I'm sorry, was there another question?
Well, I was just thinking about this. So doctors, you mentioned so many of them are getting out of private practice. And in private practice, you know, that relationship is so great between the doctor and the patient. But so you have this going on, as well as you mentioned earlier, all the paperwork. And I know many doctors, they're like, I want to take care of patients instead of sitting here at my computer inputting data.
Right. And as a patient, I can tell you that I just want to rip that laptop right out of her lap and throw it against the wall. Look at me. Can you please look at me? Can you put your hands on me and do a physical exam? Get off the damn computer.
But they have to. I mean, they have to do this stuff, right?
They have to. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they don't. You know what? They don't have to do it right in front of you. There's such a thing as taking notes, then going to a computer and typing in your stuff.
But still, I don't think they should have to do that.
That lasted for 3 hours. That could have been a 30-minute appointment because as I'm talking, she's typing it in, going back, making mistakes, changing over to this page and this page and this page. It's kind of like, lady, you're wasting my time. I could have been out of here in an hour at the most, and it's been 3 hours now.
But they're being forced to do that, Jill, right?
Yes.
Doing rules and regulations and all that stuff.
Right. Well, it's the electronic medical records. So somebody can collect data. It's all data collection. That's all it is.
Got it.
It's silly. So with this universal health care, they want to make it sound like, oh, this is wonderful, and Medicare for all, isn't that wonderful? Well, no, it's not. So this is how government or any limited resource organization, this is how they control health care costs. They limit the services. We've seen that happen. They decrease reimbursement to physicians. This is all stuff that's already happened with Medicare and Medicaid. They increase the premiums, happened with all of them. They increase taxes to the entire population. And then they borrow money because it's gone bankrupt. Medicare is bankrupt. There used to be, there is a Medicare trust fund. Well, the problem, as you can imagine, most people didn't live to be 65 when Medicare was enacted in like 1965. So, the people were paying it into the Medicare taxes through payroll deduction, right? Payroll deduction. Paying into Medicare, the bureaucrats and politicians saw this big pile of money sitting in the Medicare trust fund. Oh, my God. You know, how can we not spend that? You know, wow. It's like a little kid with a full piggy bank. So they started to spend the money and replace the money with IOUs. So the Medicare trust fund is out of money. The trust fund is empty. The only way that Medicare is being paid for now is ongoing payroll deductions. It used to be that we had something like a bunch of people, I can't remember what it was, 20 or something, workers paying into Medicare for every Medicare patient that was taking money out of Medicare. That was, you know, the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. Now, every Medicare patient that's getting Medicare services is usually using at least twice as much to three times as much health care as what they paid into.
Wow.
That's what they paid into the system. So now we're at like a 2-to-1, two workers for every Medicare patient, and the whole baby boomers, our generation, hasn't even gotten to 65 years old yet.
Oh, boy.
So it is fiscally insolvent at this point, and there is no plan for how we would ever, you know, the Medicare trust fund will never be paid back. It's full of IOUs from the government because they spent the money. So this is, you know, again, you put this in charge, you put government people in charge in order to keep getting reelected. What do? They got to give people stuff. They got to give people stuff. Where does that money come from? Oh, well, it comes, let's take it from the Medicare trust fund. Let's take it from Social Security. Let's take it from this and this and this because we got these piles of money there, and then we can stay in office and we can keep our power. And I mean, it's just this horrible, corrupt system, all that's been created by the government.
So
yeah.
Okay. So
now, do you want to keep going?
Yes, let's do. My question is, how do we fix this? But continue on because it's important that people understand this.
Right. Okay. So, and this is where we're going to go. The question is, why do we treat healthcare differently than anything else? People say, because it's so complicated, because it's so complex, nobody could ever work this through. They've made it complex. It doesn't have to be that complex. I don't know how to fix a car. I don't know how to fix my car, but I find somebody that I trust. I take my car in. They explain to me. They look at my car. They explain to me what needs to be done, how much it will cost me. I get to look at that and say, do this, but don't do this. Do this, but don't do this. Or I get to say, I think I'll take my car somewhere else, and I may or may not get back to you. I want a second opinion. That's how we should deal with healthcare. It should be the same thing. I don't know how to fix my computer. I take it to somebody that knows how to fix computers. I trust somebody else to make those decisions, but they also tell me what it's going to cost, and I agree or don't agree to spend that money. But I know ahead of time what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to do. That's what we need to do with healthcare. At this point, this is another huge problem, and nobody talks about this. I think you and I have talked about it on the show before. So I got a bill for cancer surgery. It was for $90,000. That was the charge from the hospital, directly from the hospital for the room and the OR and all that. That wasn't the bills from the doctors and surgeons, right?
Wow.
So this was just from the hospital, $90,000. My insurance company didn't pay quickly enough. So I get a letter from the hospital saying, you will be responsible for the full $90,000 that your insurance doesn't pay up. Well, then within a week, the insurance company had paid. Then I get the little notice, like, this is not a bill. You know, we're just letting you know what's happening with these charges. And it says, paid $9,000, right? 10% mm-hmm. of what I would have had to pay. The insurance company pays $9,000, and it's all taken care of. That's a scam. That shouldn't even be legal, in my opinion. That's ridiculous. But for the people who don't have insurance or the people who aren't looking closely enough, they think that, well, the people without insurance would be expected to pay that $90,000. And then if they go into the hospital and say, how about if I pay cash, you know, or can we work something out? The hospital will say, oh, we're going to be really big about this. We're going to give you a 20 or 30% discount.
Uh-huh.
And that's crap. That's
okay.
Crap. If you're going to pay cash, that makes their cash flow wonderful, right? Because they don't get paid that quickly from an insurance company. If they gave you the same deal that they're giving the insurance company and you paid cash for it, think how much better off that hospital system or provider would be. They got good cash flow, right? Somebody's paying cash up front.
Right. Well, so
reasons they should be able to give you more than a 90% discount. Why does that number exist anyway? Why does the 90,000 even exist? It's a made up number.
So my question is that so that they can write off, on their taxes?
Yes.
Or something?
Yes, a big portion, because when hospitals submit, to the government how much unreimbursed care or how much under-reimbursed care or how much charity, right, how much charity care they give, then they can use that big number.
Okay.
And it looks good to everybody. We've given $4 million worth of health care, blah, blah, blah.
Got it.
The other thing is, and I believe that this is true as well, the insurance companies go along with it because really this is the providers are making these charges. But the insurance companies are allowing it to happen because people look at that big number. They look at that big number and say, oh, my God, I could never not have insurance.
Uh-huh.
I could never not have insurance that would cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because, oh, there's no way. We'd be bankrupt. And when they say people are going bankrupt because of medical bills, it's because of this. It's because of this scam.
Right.
If they only had to pay the 10% number, and I think they should pay less than that because nobody has to go through all the process of all the coding and billing and billing and billing, all they'd have to do is have a transaction with me. Say, this is what it is. You give me your HSA card and say, and we're going to talk about how that could all work
okay.
in just a minute. But this could be an easy transaction. It doesn't have to be this complicated, but it's to the benefit of the insurance companies and the providers like not having to deal with patients. They don't want to really deal with patients individually. And let's face it, a lot of people don't pay their bills. But if you asked in a large number, you could have the majority of transactions, the majority of services rendered could be paid at the time of service or prior to service, right?
Right.
But let's face it, the providers would rather deal with another company than with an individual, a whole bunch of different individuals,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can't blame them for that in a lot of ways, but at the same time, it's a scam. And it shouldn't, in my opinion, I don't know why this is legal.
Well, that's what the government does. It legalizes things like theft, like taking stuff from other people.
Exactly.
You know, it's like right. Interesting.
Yeah. What do they call it? Accessory to a crime. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we could decrease. So when you think about it, if we could just address this one issue, just address this issue, you could decrease healthcare costs by between, I think, 70 to 90%.
Oh, my gosh.
Right off the bat. 70 to 90% of healthcare costs. Now, so that brings us to the solutions.
Okay.
Number one, post prices. Have everybody, and it doesn't have to be like on a big poster board or anything, but certainly, for crying out loud, if I shop on Amazon, I know what I'm paying. And you think about the extensive list of service of products that they supply on Amazon. Why is it they can post prices and a doctor can't?
You know, right? And what's so interesting on that conversation, it kind of circles back to what you'd said. I can't recall. There's so many times where you might say, I might say to a provider, oh, how much does that cost? And their response is, oh, insurance covers that. You'll just have to pay, you know, your deductible. And I used to go down the road and go, okay, now it's like, no, how much does it cost? Posting prices would really make a difference.
Right. So here's a call to action to everybody. Always ask, even I don't care how you're going to pay for it. Always ask, what would it be if I paid cash for this? And I can tell you something else. Because one of the things is when you go down that road, they'll say, well, we have to check with your insurance company. And they think you're just going to walk away. And I stand there and say, I'll wait. Go ahead. I got nothing else going on. Go ahead. I'll wait. So then they have to check with the insurance. Or we'll have to get the billing person. That's okay. I'll talk. Bring the billing person out here. I'd like to talk to her. I mean, I've done this at offices, and it's kind of like, you know, they don't know what to do with you. But if you're very nice about it, they will eventually get the numbers to you that you need. What you may find out is it's cheaper for you to just pay cash, a cash price for something, than to have them go through your insurance company for it, and then you have to pay cash through your HSA anyway, because it's going to cost you most of the time because you're never going to meet your deductible, right?
Right.
If you got $6,000 or $8,000 in deductible, it's to your benefit to figure out which way is better for you.
Right.
If you've got a health savings account, you're going to have to pay, literally, it's your money anyway. You're paying cash for it one way or another, either through your deductible or just cash. So you're better off saying, okay, tell me how much this is going to be. Going through my insurance, like what discount has my insurance company, you know, so gracefully and wonderfully arranged for me to have? And you frequently it's less than an outright cash price, because now a lot of these providers are coming up with cash prices. So it's entirely to your benefit to ask those questions and be nice about it. Don't be mean. Don't be obnoxious. Don't be rude. Be nice about it, and the other thing I tried to explain to this one group was, it really, you should be, it's to your benefit to understand this too. And they were shocked when they saw those numbers. They're like, hold on, you're kidding me. Wow, I had no idea it was like this. The doctor had no idea how much a Pneumovax vaccine cost. They had no idea it was $500 for a shingles, or, you know, for some kind of vaccine that they wanted me to have. They had no idea it was that expensive.
Wow. And
it's craziness. The providers don't know it. So start asking. And the more we ask as consumers, the more incentive they're going to have to provide these numbers. Right?
Right.
So that's how we do it. We don't have to have a corrupt politician with lobbyists at their front door all the time. We don't have to have them make these decisions for us all the time. There's a lot we can do on our own. So number one, post prices.
Okay.
Next one, minimize the insurance mandates. So you should only have to pay for insurance that you need. I'm 61 years old. I'm not going to get pregnant unless there's an immaculate conception, right? And then we're all in trouble. So I shouldn't have to pay for maternity care or breast pump or a child car seat. I shouldn't have to pay if I, you know, I'm married, but if I wasn't married, I shouldn't have to pay for PSA tests and screening for prostate cancer in a man. But that's what the system is right now. We are all having to pay for services that we will never use, but that somebody else will use. Well, that's crap. Unless you're in a group policy, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So, and I think you should own your own policy. I'll put that in there now. But we'll talk about that more in a minute. You should only have to pay for what you may need. And in my opinion, it should be only catastrophic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should pay for most of your health care in cash with a posted discounted price, a price that is between 10 and 30% of that charge garbage scam that's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So when you really look at it, the 10% number, wow, you know, your office visit shouldn't be more than $50. It's ridiculous what's being charged. Let's see here. Let's use real insurance, not prepaid health care, just like we talked about with cars. So let's have catastrophic insurance and then with a high deductible, but you negotiate the prices.
Okay.
Let's expand health savings accounts. You should be able to save as much money in a health savings account as you want. Your employer should treat it like a 401k. Your employer should be able to contribute money to your health savings account. A lot of them already do, which is great. Once you're able to accumulate a lot of money in a health savings account, it can only be used for medical expenses. Only used for medical expenses. But let's say you could pass that on to your heirs. Intact, only used for medical expenses. You could donate it to a charity, like maybe a church could have a health savings account set up for its members or people in need. And that money, again, can only go for medical expenses. Why doesn't that exist now? If it does, I'd love for somebody to tell me, but I've been looking and I don't see it.
Okay.
Right? So let's expand health savings accounts. That in and of itself, you think about what that could do in one or two generations to the need for Medicare, the need for Medicaid.
So right? we could fix
charities,
it. Yeah, okay.
You could fix it. You could get the government out of our health care just by expanding health savings accounts, using real insurance, posting prices and decreasing the overall burdens of billing and coding and all this crap that providers have to go for. Those things all increase, all the regulations, all that increases the cost to providers to provide the health care. You decrease their overhead, you increase their cash flow, and prices are going to continue to go down. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next thing, separate insurance from the workplace. We've talked about that. The reason that pre-existing conditions are a problem is because insurance is tied to the workplace. You lose your job, you get laid off, whatever, you get fired, you've lost your insurance. Then you have to go in the individual market where you can't balance your risk with other people as easily. So you have to pay higher premiums. You may not even be insured if you have pre-existing conditions. Then you go into these high-risk pools that I think are a sad – I think we can do much better than high-risk pools because those policies are – those premiums are incredibly huge. Why would you balance risk? I mean, the idea of group policies is you're balancing risk with low-risk people and high-risk people. So why would you have a high-risk pool where everybody has to pay huge premiums because they're all high-risk? It's like counterintuitive to me. What you should do is put the high-risk people that are uninsurable on an individual policy level, arrange for them to get into a group policy of some kind so that that risk can be diluted out and, you can afford a policy and you can afford to pay for it on your own instead of being put like in a leper colony, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of like what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can change that and make that better.
Okay.
So in separate insurance from the workplace, in other words, you own your policy. It goes with you wherever you go. Ben Carson, when he was running for president in 2015, said, and I've said this many times, you should be, when you're born, you can be issued an insurance policy. It doesn't have to stay with the same company, but as long as you have an insurance policy with no more than, let's say, 3 months lag in like when you change companies or some circumstances change, if you don't have any more than 3 months uninsured, then you should be able to have an insurance policy that will go with you over and over between companies and so forth with no pre-existing condition penalties.
Because that's been really the sticky wicket, I think, that has scared people to
right.
like support Obamacare or something is because of that whole pre-existing condition question.
Right.
So that can be fixed as well.
You know, it's like, yeah, solve the origin of the problem, right? Solve it. And the reason that pre-existing conditions are a problem is because we've tied insurance to the workplace.
Okay.
Period. Think how many people stay in a crap job, a job that they hate, and with a boss that is treating them poorly or a company that doesn't respect them. They stay in that rotten job because of the health insurance. or they take a job that they don't want because of the health insurance,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people. I think this could free up a lot of people, and it would allow them control over their own healthcare destiny.
Love it.
Again, post prices. Now we're on to number 7, allow flexibility in risk pools, which I kind of touched on there. So have fewer individual policies. Now, Trump already has passed, I think it was an executive order, allowing different groups. Like you could have a group policy, an association like the Realtors Association or Seed Farmers Association that could pool and self-insure themselves as an association. So they get all these small, let's say, all these small co-ops and farmers that are part of this association could all pool their money and be self-insured as an association.
Mm-hmm.
That's where people with high risk or pre-existing conditions, if they could find an association or some affiliation that could self-insure, or like MediShare, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those MediShare or religious organizations that are allowed to do it right now, more and more people are going to that lost their couldn't afford insurance through Obamacare. A lot of them are going on to MediShare now.
Okay.
Pharmaceutical reform, Trump is working on that.
Right.
But that's another, it's ridiculous. For people who don't know, this is I talked before about asking cash, what's it going to cost if we go through my insurance, whatever discount they've arranged for me, even though I'm still paying cash, paying through my HSA versus paying cash outright. Costco, CVS, Target, Walmart can be the best prices for pharmaceuticals. Most of it's good. A ton of it is generic now. You can even get it posted. They have it posted on their pharmaceutical aspects of their websites. I mean, this is a great, and this existed for a long time, but ask them. I've had it cost $100 less for hydroxychloroquine when I was on it for autoimmune. It was going to be $165. The cost, the charge was $165 for a month's supply. Crazy. If I went through my insurance, the deduction that they negotiated for me on my behalf, God bless them, was down to $110 for a month. I said, what would it be if I just paid cash for it outright and didn't go through my insurance company? $50.
Wow.
$50. And she said, oh, if you're going to pay cash, then we have a coupon you can use. So now it's $40. Okay,
wow.
So folks, it is in your best interest to ask. Ask the questions. Don't be ashamed. Stand there and wait for them to reply. The pharmacies are really getting good at it. So they're used to this. They're going to be, they've been very nice every time I've asked them to do that. The doctor's offices can be a little funky, but man, stand your ground. Do it.
Okay.
Tort reform, you and I talked about it. Defensive medicine. Doctors ordering tests and prescribing medications just to cover their butts is a huge issue. And some people think it may be up to 25 or 30% of the overall cost of healthcare in our country could be defensive medicine. And I certainly do too as a patient, that a lot of stuff is ordered just to make the doctor feel better, not to make you feel better, just to make them feel better or to make them feel less at risk in case they've made a mistake.
Right. So it's all interconnected,
exactly.
The pharmaceuticals,
exactly.
The tort reform, it's all connected. And the poor doctor, he's just trying to cover his rear end or her rear end. Yeah.
Right. And the last one, post prices, price transparency. So those are the ideas. Now, the way you could combine these ideas, the perfect, in my opinion, the perfect, a great arrangement for everybody is a direct primary care membership. It's not the same as concierge, but direct primary care is like you pay a membership. It's not insurance, but you pay a membership to a primary care group. They're usually frequently double boarded in family medicine or internal medicine and emergency medicine. Some of them actually have urgent care clinics within their practice, but you pay a certain fee, say $300 a month.
Okay.
For a family of four, $300 a month, because we want to have catastrophic insurance, right, to pay for the really high ticket cancers, big illnesses, car accidents, injuries, that sort of thing. Not car, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Car accident. Some accident.
Yeah.
Forget the car part, but some accident.
Mm-hmm.
So we have catastrophic insurance. Then you get a direct primary care membership. With these memberships, it's a few hundred dollars a month for your whole family. You go there, you get all your basic labs, EKGs, chest x-rays. Those frequently are included in your membership. Most of them have a very generous number of free office visits that are included in the membership. Some of them are unlimited office visits included in the membership. A lot of them will have, like I said, urgent care, 24/7 care included in the membership. And then they will have negotiated prices with labs and radiology, sometimes with gastroenterology for colonoscopy or other basic kind of preventive measures and tests. They'll have negotiated prices, like labs that are $120 if you go through your insurance will be $4. And that's because they've worked out an arrangement so that as a whole group, that primary care group sends the lab a single bill for all their patients, the lab sends the group a single bill for all the patients that have been done by that lab that belong to that primary care group. The primary care group pays the lab directly. Can you imagine the cost savings to that
wow.
lab of not having to bill 18 times, not having to mail out all
right.
of these notices and junk? Because how many notices do you get before it's even paid? I mean, sometimes I'll have 20 notices. This is not a bill. This is not a bill. This is not a bill. Why don't you just let me know when it is a bill? Okay, can we just do that?
That's for
so,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what makes it, that's another thing that makes it confusing, right?
It is.
So these memberships, these primary care memberships, they're becoming more and more frequent, more prevalent up north in Denver and northern Colorado. There are a lot of these groups. For some reason, southern Denver, south Denver does not have these groups. And I don't know why. But it's a great business model. Then the docs love it because they can see 10 patients instead of 30 patients. It's perfect for people who have pre-existing conditions or chronic illness like diabetes, heart disease, multiple diseases. It's great for families with kids with special needs, that sort of thing. Because you have unlimited office visits, you have great continuity of care, the docs are not rushed to get you in and out. They have the urgent care for families with little kids that are constantly breaking an arm or something like mm-hmm. that. It's a brilliant practice model, and we need to have more of them. But that would fill that gap for people who can't afford insurance and have pre-existing conditions or chronic conditions. The primary care membership is perfect. Right now, you can't do that membership through Medicare. Why? You should be able to do that membership. That's perfect, perfect for Medicare patients because they're the most likely to have multiple medical conditions, right? I mean, why are we doing that instead of a fee-for-service that's so much more expensive through Medicare?
Okay, Jill.
And then we have the health savings accounts.
Okay, so let's go through the 10. Just boom, 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 so that people have them in their minds.
Okay. Number one, post prices. Number two, minimize insurance mandates. Number three, let's have real insurance, i.e. catastrophic insurance, instead of this prepaid health care. Number four, expand health savings accounts. Number five, separate insurance from the workplace. You own your insurance policy, no more pre-existing conditions. Number six, post prices. Number seven, allow flexibility in risk pools so that fewer people have to have an individual policy, which is more higher premiums. Number eight, pharmaceutical reform. Number nine, tort reform. Number 10, did we mention post-crisis?
Dr. Jill Vecchio, to my knowledge, nobody else in the country has come out with this. I think that we should wrap this up and send this to President Trump because we need to be talking about health care. So this is a very important podcast. My friends, share it, listen to it, understand it. You now have your talking points to talk to people when they say, we need Medicare for all or universal health care. No, we don't. Dr. Jill Vecchio, final thought you'd like to leave with everybody?
Take it upon yourself to ask for cash price. Ask your providers to give you information on cash prices. I don't care how you're going to pay for it. Ask for cash.
Okay. Dr. Jill Vecchio, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, and my friends, God bless you and God bless America.